later than... Sure. But what happens is somewhere between the first sip of the first beer and the bottom of the second one, I get this phenomenon of craving Dr. Silkworth talks about. And I don't get home at 7. I leave the office of the club at exactly 1 o'clock in the morning because they...
Quite a few pilots here, Bob.
And drive home with a hand over one eye. Right? Anybody know why I'm that? Okay. And I walk in the house, my first wife tears into me. There's a lot of information in that sentence. Play it back slow. And head into the bathroom for my after drinking chores. Yes. Yeah, I thought the two greatest inventions of the 20th century, I think both invented by alcoholics, were that little half-moon shape of carpet they put around the commode for you to kneel on. It was invented by one of our guys. You know, his knees were torn up in the bathroom floor. He says, we ought to put... And that soft commode seat you could rest your head on, kind of in between heaves, you know. They think our people aren't creative. I mean, really. So I'm in there puking up my toenails. And I see the hands of the pukers. Come on, where are you? Pukers. These are my people. Okay, let's try this one. Who quit forever solemn oath on the Bible in front of witnesses at least once? Wow, nice turnout tonight. Yeah, these are my people. You betcha. Who peed in the closet? Did you really? I never did that. I'm very embarrassed for you. That's, I don't believe I'd have told that. There's a big, you want to talk to your sponsor about the difference between a sharing in a meeting and a fist step. They're very different. You need to be careful. I never did that, and I really am embarrassed for you. Although I will admit that my first wife is still angry about that coffee table that used to be in the living room. Okay, I will admit that to you. Who takes meetings into jails and prisons? Come on, way up. I want everybody to take a look and get these faces, okay? Because you're going to need this. Thank you. If you're suffering from depression, get with one of these people and take a meeting into the jail. It will break a depression so fast. So fast. It's better than anything else being prescribed. And I did that gag. I ad-libbed it one night in Depot at the county lockup. 25 guys sitting around. They don't laugh much in the jail, by the way, for those of you who don't take meetings into the jail. But they did that night because one guy put up his hand and I worked him over like I did you. And when I got all done, he said, hey, man, no big deal. It wasn't my closet. It's a perspective thing, I suppose. And puking my guts. Oh, and let's try another one here. Another audience participation. Here you go. I think there are three pre-AA prayers. They are, God help me pass this test I didn't study for. Everybody recognize that one? Please don't let her be pregnant. Recognize that one? And we'll do the third one. I'm now praying to the porcelain Buddha. I'm in there on the prayer rug in the bathroom. And, the prayer rug. And I would pray the pre-AA prayer. I'm going to do the first line. You're going to do the second line. Are you ready? God, get me out of this. Which is alcoholic for amen. You left that out. Right? And I brush my teeth and go to bed. And it's got to be 3 o'clock in the morning. And I get up at 6. Yeah. In that wonderland between drunk and hungover. I miss that so much. And at 7:30 that morning, I'm in that airplane I was telling you about. The Thunderbirds flew this plane. We did almost everything they did. Two-ship formation today. And just after liftoff, I've tucked up under the leader's tail. The gear's coming up, and I'm climbing under him. And his afterburner's right there. If I can stand up, I can almost touch it. And we're going to be pulling 5Gs going over the top. And I am dying of a hangover. I am dying. And the only thing that keeps me going is the sure and certain knowledge I'll never feel this way in a plane again because, you see, last night I quit forever. I meant it with all my heart. I just realized about 2 years ago that every time I quit forever, I actually meant it. You know, I wasn't faking them out a couple of times. But generally, I really meant it. And I'm dying in that plane. Dying. And by 5:30 that afternoon, 22-year-old body is pretty resilient. I'm not well yet. I tell you one thing I know for sure. I'm not getting drunk tonight. I got an 8:15 launch tomorrow morning. Nobody with a brain to get drunk the night before going out to fly a mission like that. But I do want to socialize the other pilots of my squadron. I think I'll drop by the club and have one beer. No more than, I should be home by 6:30, no later than. But I leave the club at exactly 1 because they, and I drive home drunk and I listen to her and I puke my guts out and God get me out of this. Very good on the amen. A chorus of amens. Yeah. And that's that phenomenon of craving that we're talking about. And I did that over and over and over again. And I could not look into the past all the way to yesterday and say, man, weren't you dying of a hangover yesterday when we released breaks and every day last week and every day last month? And I was powerless over alcohol, and I was ignorant of the fact that I was powerless over alcohol, and that is a rough combination. And I lived it for an awful lot of years after that, tremendous number of years. The book never gives us a definition of alcoholism. It never gives us a definition of alcoholic, but it gives us some pretty good descriptions. Let's take a look at Roman numeral 30, XXX. This is two pages before page one, Dr. Silkworth. And I'm just going to catch a couple of them. Second paragraph from the bottom, two pages before page one. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. Page 21, American numerals, as my friend says. Page 21, first full paragraph. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his alcohol consumption once he starts to drink. Page 30. About five lines down. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. I could do one or the other. There were times when I could control my drinking, but baby, if I did, I was not enjoying it. Because if I was enjoying it, it was out of control. I could never seem to do them both at the same time. Page 39. About six lines down. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be, here we go in italics, absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. How important is that? This is a point we wish to emphasize and reemphasize to smash home upon our alcoholic readers that has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. They're not going to teach me enough here to keep me sober. I have the privilege of taking meetings into treatment centers. I always tell them that. They're not going to teach you enough here to keep you sober. They're going to teach you what to do. If you do it, you'll stay sober. Knowing it won't be worth anything. I've got a friend who has a photographic memory. The first couple of days he was in treatment, he read the big book, and he can come pretty close to reciting it. He drank three more years. This will never be about what I know. This is about what I do. Page 44. This is the one where they got me. Fourth line. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control of the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. I get here without an arrest record. I haven't been in a fight since I was 12 years old. I was married to the same woman for over 20 years at that time. I'm a college graduate. I was an officer in the United States Air Force. At 26, I was an instructor pilot on a four-engine jet for the Air Force. I own my own business. I made a phenomenal amount of money. It's gone, by the way. I was living in a 4,000-square-foot, very nice house in a very posh neighborhood, driving a very flashy ride. I had a boat on the lake. I didn't drink every day. I didn't drink in the morning. I never had a blackout. I could explain myself out of alcoholism very clearly until they got me here. They nailed my shorts to the outhouse door right here on page 44. If when you honestly want to, and when I was on that prayer rug puking out my nose, I honestly wanted to. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control of the amount you take, right? And I have one or two to be home by 6:30 or 7. My problem was that every once in a while I got out to have one or two to be home by 6:30 or 7, and I had one or two and was home by 6:30 or 7. And that happened often enough to where I was sure it was going to happen every time. I could not look at the evidence. We talk about telling the truth. And I love this one on page 1, Bill's story. About five lines down. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. Well, that's my experience. And then it says, I was part of life at last. That was the big one for me. When I was drinking, I was part of it. I belonged. I was one of you. And when I wasn't, I was alone. And I think my favorite description is on page 23. No offense. Paragraph in the middle of the page, first line, once in a while he may tell the truth. I didn't spread the truth around too thick. I saved it for emergencies. There's a wonderful line in a Jack Nicholson movie. He says, I'll always give you some version of the truth. That makes perfect sense to me. Perfect, perfect sense. It was hard for me to find my alcoholism. Because I'm uncaught. I tell the guys in the jails and prisons all the time, we got two kinds of people at my home group. We got convicted felons and unconvicted felons. That's all we got. Come on down. We hope you're going to be at home. I was badly confused. Let's take a look at, whenever I refer to the short form of the step, I'm talking about page 59 or in the case of step 12 on page 60. Take a look at the short form of step 1. It says 1, and here's the way I originally read it. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, therefore our lives had become unmanageable. On close examination, I have discovered that the word therefore does not appear in the first step. Figured it out by myself. There's actually a hyphen there. And I looked up punctuation in the dictionary, and a hyphen connects two separate thoughts. The reason I was confused about that was on June the 27th, 1984, the day of my most recent drink, the fact that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was crashing down around my ears were related. Here in late September 2006, I am powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable. I'm not playing with you. This is one of the most powerful concepts I ever got. Please try to hear it to the end if this doesn't make any sense to you. I have fired me as general manager of my own life based on my performance. A good manager would have fired me several decades ago. And one of the first things I did this morning when I woke up was I invited God in to run my life today. I volunteered. And I said, whatever you have in mind today suits me just fine. And then I asked him to help me send love to the places I was going today. I sent love to this room this morning, not knowing where it was. Something I learned from my wife. Those of you who have heard me before, I talk about this watch that I have. I think it's terribly unattractive. But I bought it because it has multiple alarms on it. The second alarm is set for the get-up time. This morning they were set 10 minutes apart. The first one goes off 10 minutes before the get-up time, and Miss Linda and I cuddle and we do our morning prayers in each other's arms. If you can come up with a better way to start your day, call me collect. I'd like to hear it. I really would like to hear it. And I'll grant you that there are times when the second alarm awakens one or both of us. I give you that. But step 11 does not say achieved through prayer and meditation. It says sought. And on those mornings where one or both of us goes back to sleep during prayer, we sought. That's about as good as it gets. That's how I get to start my life. So I want to go back to this idea of unmanageable. I cannot find a place in the book that promises me manageability. I mean, where it says, congratulations, now having achieved this lofty spiritual level, your life is now manageable. The keys are in it, the tank's full, load up. Somebody shout out the page number. I can't find it either, and I have searched. I do find some places that promise me sanity. Let's take a look at the top of page 57, because it promises me sanity here. Say if for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink has never returned, at such a time a great revulsion has risen up in him. If you have my experience and history with alcohol, that would be a sane reaction. And then it says, seemingly could not drink even if you would, God had restored his sanity. What is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. What are elements? That's the lowest common denominator. What are the elements of this healing? And here they are. Circumstances made him willing to believe. In my case, I worked my fanny into a crack I couldn't lie or fake my way out of. And then it says, he humbly offered himself to his maker. Then he didn't say, get me out of this and I'll never do it again. He didn't say, you know, let's make a deal. He said, take me. And I don't care what the terms are. I'll sign the bottom. You can fill it in later. Then he knew. Huge difference from give me a little help and I'll take it from here. And then it says, even so has God restored us all to our right minds. To this man the revelation was sudden. Some of us grew into it more slowly. And here's a promise. But he has come to all who have honestly sought him. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. I'm told that God is kind of like the mother of a three-year-old playing hide and seek with her child. Where does she hide? She hides where the child can find her. Yeah. And so it is only incumbent upon me to seek. I don't have to find God. I have to seek. I heard this in a meeting one time, and it hit me so hard I wrote it down. Actually, I stood up. I've only had that experience once in a meeting, to hear somebody say something so powerful it brought me out of my chair. And she was not trying to be profound, as I am now. It was in the middle of a paragraph, and she was just telling the truth, and she said, "I'm having trouble getting a grip on letting go." I thought, yeah, I'm having trouble getting a grip on letting go. Uh-huh. And not too terribly long ago, I was talking to a fellow I've been sponsoring for a number of years, and he's referring to this particular situation. He said, "I've been obsessing a little bit about this," and he went on for some time. And see, it didn't light you up either. Only alcoholics would take the term obsessing a little bit. See, that made sense to you. Blew that right by you. Blew that right by you. Mm-hmm. And this one is most recent, one of the young men that I have the privilege of sponsoring. He says, I'm not obsessing about this girl. I just think about her all the time. The other men that I sponsor were astounded to hear that I was struck dumb. I did not have a response for about a four count. And then he said, "Did I say that?" I said, "Yeah, that one came out, man." I'm really sorry for you, but that one got out. This is one that Bob and I like to do together, page 35 and 36. The first question is asked at the top of page 35, and I think it's one of the great questions in all of recovery. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? All right, so that's the question. They set us up for a pretty long time until they give us the answer at the top of the next page. And after all that setup, it says, "Yet he got drunk again. We ask him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story." Please observe the difference. What we asked for was exactly how it happened. What we got was his story. Got it? Okay. And if you will be his story.
"I came to work on Tuesday morning."
Time out. What happened to Monday? A lot of guys go to work on Monday. What, do you cut hair for a living? I mean, why didn't you go to work on Monday? Go ahead.
"I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I'd once owned."
Irritated? How about bent? How about twisted? How about the veins in your neck have popped out? How about your undies are on a permanent wad? How about you can just barely stand it?
"I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious."
Oh, you had a fight with the boss that wasn't serious. Wait a minute. Has anybody here ever had a fight with a boss that wasn't serious? Fights with the boss are always serious. Let's skip down here, now that we have the basis for where we're going, to the italics a couple of paragraphs down.
"Suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach."
Exact same thinking. The exact same thinking. And I think that is so critically important to have a sponsor. Is because if this guy had had that phone call with his sponsor, who had responded as I did, and we looked at the truth instead of his story, this thing might not have worked out the way it did. Step one is the basis for the whole thing. There's one more thing, if I can find it. Bottom of page 41. Italics again. "Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all." That's what happens. I heard somebody in a meeting the other day use the reference to a cancer ward, and if somebody walked in and said, "Boy, we just give you 12 steps, you can all be well," they'd jump all over it. The difference between them and me is that cancer isn't their answer. Cancer's their problem. Alcohol wasn't my problem. It was my answer. If I'm going to lay down the old answer, I'm going to have to pick up a new answer, and the new answer is going to have to be at least as good as the old answer. It's going to have to be. I'm going to give you my situation tonight. Here's my recovery. This ring sort of I'm holding up here. Here's what hangs from it. My life. How many times do you think a drunken pilot with a couple of thousand hours could have been killed? Not to mention driving drunk and all the other things that we do. My sanity. I have been to the insane asylum. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. I've been in the little rubber room in underwear with no doorknob on my side. Been there. My freedom. I'm supposed to be serving life in a military prison. I flew a mission classified above top secret, and I was so drunk at 4 one morning taxiing it out, tacked it off into the weeds. Couldn't even keep it on the pavement. Possibly some of you have had that experience with other types of vehicles. I thought so, yeah. Okay, so my life, my freedom, my sanity, my relationship with this fabulous woman that I'm married to, and our children, my job, my house, my cars, my peace of mind. There's nothing in my life that means anything to me that isn't suspended from my recovery. For if I lose it, all of those things hit the floor and shatter. And I'm not proposing that that's your situation tonight. I'm telling you it's mine. I stand before you tonight needing to win this time. Page 39. Talk about the differences between two concepts here, and then I'm going to turn it over to Bob. About 6 lines from the bottom over to the right, bottom of page 39, he made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. All right, and then he goes on and drinks some more. All right, I'm just want to do that one sentence. And let's turn over to the bottom of 42. 6 lines from the bottom. But the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, that would be the 12 steps, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. So making up my mind not to drink did not work for me. It did not work. What worked for me was making up my mind and committing, like I said, the feet, not the lips, to actually going through this process, to making this thing happen. Let's take a look at page 52. I'll do this one more thing, and then I'm going to turn back to you. Page 52. For those of you who are new, I'll ask you to just kind of nod if any of these apply to you. It says, middle of the page, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. Has anybody ever had that experience? We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. You had some of that? Couldn't make a living. We're having a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We're unhappy. Couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Have you had those experiences? Okay, hang on to page 52. We're going to refer to that again, so keep a hand in there and flip over to 83. This is what we affectionately know as the 9 step promises. There are promises all over the book. I think there's somewhere over 160. Bottom of page 83, if we are painstaking about this phase, that would be step 9, assuming you've done the first 8 with a sponsor who's already done them. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. I love that. The old freedom and the old happiness don't work anymore. I must have a new one. It says, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. It doesn't say God will suddenly begin to do it. It says our realization will be sudden. Those are different. Okay. You got page 52? You got page 83 and 84? Been living what's on page 52? Like to live on what's on 83 and 84? Then do what lies between. Don't learn it. Don't believe it. God knows. Please don't interpret it. Do it. My sponsor said meet the conditions. And that's not all of the program, but that's how I got from living on page 52 to living on page 83 and 84. I have all of that right now. I have to tell you, too, a fabulous misread happened at one of the groups in Nashville. We read the 9-step promises in most of the meetings as part of the opening. And somebody handed that to a girl that was still in treatment. And she read, fear of people and of economic insecurity will level us. I like the ones that are true. I had an experience a number of years ago. I was having a discussion with another AA member before a meeting. Now, not being as spiritually evolved as I am, you might have thought it was an argument. And about that time, Joe B. walked in. And old Joe had been sober since several days before the earth began to cool. And was also highly intelligent, which is clearly going to put him on my side of this burning issue, which I can't right now remember exactly what it was. And as Joe poured his coffee, I posed the question. And I said, what do you think? And Joe said, I am not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Do not wish to engage in any controversy. neither endorse nor oppose any causes. My primary purpose is to stay sober, help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And by the time he finished that, my opponent and I were laughing pretty hard. And it took me a pretty good while. I had a revelation. I give you, if you don't have an operational definition of revelation. Revelation is when I figure out for myself something you all been trying to tell me for 6 months or longer. It's a revelation. And I went to Joe and I said, you meant that? And he says, yeah. Joe B. was living the AA preamble. You could not draw him into a controversy. And he would not allow anything to get him between his sobriety or get in between him and trying to help somebody else get sober. It's one of the happiest men I've ever known. Paul?
Thanks, Scott.
I'm Bob, still an alcoholic. Tomorrow morning, we are going to start very specifically going through the process in the book. And I'm hoping that we're going to do it in such a way that it'll become clear based on what it says in the book, melded with our own personal experience. Because that's the most powerful thing we have in AA. This is not an academic process. We share our experience, and then one alcoholic connects with that and goes, I think I can do that. But before we do that, we're going to talk a little bit more about step one. And we're spending a lot of time on step one for a couple reasons. One, the book spends, if you look at the working text, and I'm not talking about to the wives, etc., but the part that talks about the steps, a third of that process is devoted to step one because it's the most important thing we'll ever do. And 12 by 12, it says it's the first half of step one is the only thing we ever have to do 100%. Because without that, the rest of it's sort of just a moot point. It's just informational. But when you really get step one, that you're toast, then we have a reason to come to the table for the rest of this process. Page 30, chapter more about alcoholism. This is an amazing couple pages. Where I come from, there are meetings that read this at every meeting. And I've sat in meetings and heard it read, and didn't hear it. Just like you hear chapter 5 read for hundreds of times, and then one day you hear it. And it's, I think, a lot of books like that for me. It starts off, it says, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. That's something that we seem to have in common. There's something about us, we don't want to be alcoholic. We don't want to come to AA. I would rather be a mental health case that needs medication than an alcoholic. I would rather be a drug addict than an alcoholic. God, a drug addict is more panache than that. I mean, there's rock stars that are drug addicts. There's nothing to look up to an alcoholic. I don't want to be an alcoholic. Even after four or five treatment centers, when I've been intellectually bludgeoned into an acceptance that I got alcoholism, even then, it was, yeah, but I'm a special kind of alcoholic. I was convinced that my case was unique and different, because I could tell. I looked at you. You don't look the way I feel. And so I didn't want to be a real alcoholic. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows. The bodily different is easy, the phenomenon of craving. I've watched guys drink with many years of sobriety. I go to a detox twice a week. I've been doing this kind of deal for coming up on 28 years, twice a week, without fail. And I live in an unusual city. Las Vegas, Nevada, we call it the hitting bottom capital of the world. And if you're sober, you live in Fort Myers or Orlando or West Virginia or New York City, and you're sober 25 years, 30 years, and you drink again, chances are you're going to end up on the streets in Las Vegas. It's like a magnet. It's like Disneyland for the active alcoholic. And we see these guys on the streets, and they end up in our detox. I've seen guys 45 years that drank again. 45 years. and they are bodily different from non-alcoholics, and it doesn't matter. You can never be sober long enough to outgrow the phenomenon of craving. It waits for you. It waits to burn your life to the ground. It doesn't matter how long you're sober, you never get over it. And I'm mentally different than my fellows. Now, there's a line little in a different part of the book that says that when alcoholics will stay away from drink as we do for months or years, we react, and here's the words it uses. It says we react much like other men. What's that? I thought that that for a while meant that I was going to be like other people. I was going to be normal. That's not what it means. Much like and being like are different things. A transvestite is much like a woman, but he's not.
And when you get down to the nitty-gritty, oh no, he's not. He's really not.
And what that means is I can act much like other men. I go out in the world and kind of fool them. But on a spiritual bad hair day, I don't think like other people. I make leaps in logic over, I leap over reality into things that they call alcohol logic. I jump to things and conclusions that normal people would never jump to. Early sobriety, I'd get headaches. But they weren't headaches. They were brain tumors. I could feel them growing. I could just right there. Normal person gets a headache. I get a brain tumor. I'm the kind of guy, on a bad day, my boss could say, I get a note from my boss, 9 o'clock in the morning. He wants to see me in his office at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. A normal person works hard all day, 3 o'clock, goes, sees the boss. Oh, not me. I start thinking. And I start thinking of every time I was a minute late for work. I start thinking about the customers that kind of I didn't quite get along with. I started thinking about the people I work with that don't like me. I start thinking about how they don't really appreciate what I'm doing here. I start thinking about how they're taking advantage of me. By 3 o'clock, I am ready to go into the office and tell him to take that job and just shove it. That happened to me in early sobriety, and I kept my mouth shut, and I walked into the office feeling like I wanted to tell him just to shove his job. And I was there because he wanted to give me a raise. Right? On a bad day, I can think weird stuff. That's why I have a sponsor. And the guys I sponsor, I tell them if you get a good idea, call me. If it's a brilliant idea, come and see me. Because this is alcoholism. It's not alcoholism. Now when I keep spiritually fit, I go along with the flow when and I keep my hands off my life, and it's a good thing. But I'm not cured of alcoholism. And I'm absolutely capable of, because of my alcohologic, of shooting myself in the foot sober. So I meant bodily and mentally different from our fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. That's true when we're drinking. But you know what happens when we get sober? Then you could say, therefore, it is not surprising that our thinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could think like other people. I don't think like other people. That's why I'm a sponsor. And I'll tell you something. I thought, and I think a lot of us think this, that, you know, after 10 or 15 or 20 years of sobriety, I'm sure I'm going to grow into a point where I'm just going to be able to take the helm of my own ship here. I need a sponsor today probably more than I did when I was 30 days sober. You know why? Because the enemy has been educated. And it has more information to twist around and paint pictures to me that I will buy. So I have a sponsor. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Any pursuit into the gates of insanity or death. The book talks about three illusionary states are delusions or illusions? This is the first one. This is the one that kept me from ever getting a foothold in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because as long as I had that psychotic wishful thinking, this secret yearning belief that under the right set of circumstances I could enjoy it, I could jumpstart the party and get back to the fun I had gotten when I was, say, 20 years old, and control it enough to keep the damage down to something I could live with. As long as I secretly thought I could do that, I had a back door right out of recovery. That when my emotions start putting the screws to me, and I get bored enough, lonely enough, frustrated enough, anxious enough, I am not forced to surrender here and go to my sponsor and take the prescribed actions that are outlined in this process. Because I got a back door. I just go get relief. When that door is closed once and for all, then I become a seeker in Alcoholics Anonymous for an answer. But I had another answer at the time. So I didn't need what you had. And I'll tell you what happened to me. I was sober in 1977. I was in a halfway house and I was sober about 10 or 11 months. And that's a long time with untreated alcoholism. You know, back in those days, to me, AA had good news and bad news. The good news is maybe if I went to thousands of these stupid meetings, I'll stay sober the rest of my life. And the bad news, I'm going to live a long time. Because I can't imagine life without it, really. Not forever. Because it feels like, abstinence feels like I'm doing time. So I planned a drunk. You know, sober 10 or 11 months, I mean, I've been a really good sport up to now. I mean, you know, So I got a pass out of the halfway house. Going to go meet a friend of mine that's back to drinking, the guy I was in detox with. I'm going to drink all weekend. Come back Sunday night. So I don't lose my bed. Seemed like a reasonable plan. I go down there. I think that I can control and enjoy it. I think it's going to be fun like it was when I was 20 years old. Now, it hasn't been fun like that in a while, but I can't see that truth. I see the wishful thinking. And so what happens is I go down and meet this guy. We go out to this bar. I start hammering down double shots of 100 proof with beer backs, because when you only got a weekend, you got to get downtown now. And I'm like throwing them back because I want to jumpstart the party. Because my God, I am so lonely, and I am so depressed, and I've just had it with this abstinence. I mean, a guy's entitled to a little fun, isn't he? The bizarre thing about that is that my drinking wasn't fun. Last couple years of my drinking, I drank and I felt sorry for myself. I drank and went on crying jags. I drank and preferred to be left alone so I could just feel sorry for myself. It wasn't fun. It's pathetic. I don't bathe anymore because I don't care. But I'm going to have some fun. And I remember sitting in this bar and I'm throwing down the double shots of whiskey waiting for the thing to happen. And it ain't happening. And I remember sitting there watching everybody else have a good time and wondering, what's wrong with me? And it was like a window opened before I started sinking into oblivion. And the window, like the curtain went up and I could see the truth. And I could see that this is the reality of my drinking. That all that stuff 3-4 years ago, it does not exist. This is the reality, and this has been the reality. And if you've ever seen the movie As Good As It Gets, there's a scene in there where Jack Nicholson is walking through the waiting room of a psychiatrist's office, and everybody in there is a mope. Everybody in there is depressed. They're all doing badly. They all look terrible. And he stops and he says to all of them, what if this is as good as it gets? And they all go, oh. That's what the window looks like. When you see the truth, it's like, oh, oh. And I still thought I could control it. And what happened is I never made it back. Sunday night, I came to Monday morning in a county jail facing 2 years in a state penitentiary for hit and run DUI and they said stolen car. It was not stolen. I borrowed it because people that are passed out can't say no. And I finally, the illusion that I could control and enjoy my drinking smashed. It was an illusion. It was smoke. There's no reality in it. Alcoholics Anonymous is not asking a guy like me to buy anything that's not real. It's asking me to face the truth. But the truth is a thing I resist at great length because it's painful. They say the truth will set you free, but I'm telling you, it'll ruin your day first, man. I'm telling you. It's a bad deal. So the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it in the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. I like that. That resonates with me. See, I can sit in a treatment center and I can admit I'm powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable. I can admit in a group setting a lot of stuff. It doesn't mean I really connect the dots in my innermost self. It doesn't mean I really buy it. And you know how you can tell? Watch me when I get out of the treatment center. Watch my feet. You want to know what's really going inside you? Watch your feet. I got out of treatment. I acted like a guy who had it all together. Thank you. Thanks for the information. I've learned my lesson. I'll be fine now. That's how I acted. In 1978, when I got out of detox, I went to 15 to 20 meetings a week. I called my sponsor every day. I went out to coffee with people every chance I could get. I got down on my knees, and I don't even believe in God, and I'm praying. I acted like someone who got it, that they were absolutely powerless, and I was desperate. The feet will tell you what's real. The rest is delusion. What are you doing? What are you doing? We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. Delusion number two. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. I think that this is the delusion that takes most of us out. This secret idea that alcoholism is something I can get over. In other words, like after 10 years of going to a meeting every day, I probably don't have to do that anymore. Maybe after getting my life completely together where I have the checklist. We all have a subconscious, unconscious checklist of things that we know we need to have in place to be well. Big house, wife, kids, car, good job, self-respect, comfortable, emotional well-being, nice bank account, good friends. By the time I get the checklist, you'd think by that time, I wouldn't be as alcoholic as I was when I was scared and shaken when I was 30 days sober, would I? Right? As if this is something I can get over. I have watched this dynamic, this dance of death, I bet 1,000 times in institutions over the last 28 years. Guys will go, I'll see them in detox. And man, they're just so beaten. Please help me. They call their sponsor every day. They're going to meetings. They're working the steps. They're making amends. They're trying to help other people. And then what happens at about 2 or 3 years sober? Maybe now they're making $100,000 a year. Because you get lucky when you grow along spiritual lines. And maybe now they're really busy with this promotion. I'm managing this company now. And I really can't go to a meeting every day. And I go to 2 or 3 a week. And maybe it's 6 years of sobriety. Maybe they own the business. Now they got a wife and a kid on the way. And they're really, you know, my life's very full. And I really don't have the time. And I'll check into a meeting on occasion. And I don't really need my sponsor anymore because my life's so good. I may call him up occasionally to see if he's okay. Maybe he needs my help. But I don't really need him. And I don't. And 12-step work, let's let that for the newer people. Right? And then all of a sudden somewhere, sometimes it takes 15 years to unravel what you build up in your first few. And all of a sudden one day it's crazy. A key will turn in your head. It always does. And what would have been unthinkable becomes something you do again. And we see him in the detox all the time. There was a guy a few years ago, I thought he was hilarious. Back in those days, we used to start the meeting out by asking anybody in the detox if they want to share. Well, they eventually cured us of that. We don't really want to do that anymore. I don't know why someone with 4 days sober wants to counsel a bunch of people with 20 years on about recovery, but they just want to do it. They just really need to share. I think some people get sober and they forget that what their real name is. They think their name is, does anybody want to share? You know, this guy wants to share, and he raised his hand, you know, need to share. And he wants to tell us about his life and everything. And he says the craziest thing I've ever heard. He says, I don't know why I'm here. I was making a couple $100,000 a year. I was sober 17 years. I had a wife and 3 kids that adored me, 2 cars in the garage that were both paid for, self-respect, nice house. I had everything. I don't know why I drank. As if all of that crap was a treatment for alcoholism. I feel like a diabetic in the hospital coming out of a diabetic coma saying, I don't know why I went into a diabetic coma. I have a new car. I mean, you'd want to smack him. You know, what? Are you crazy? And yet, in alcohologic, that doesn't. We don't think that sounds crazy. I don't know why I drank. I had a big house. I mean, what? What? I mean, that's nuts. But I think we often get seduced into a false sense of power by the props we obtain to prop us up. We get seduced into a false sense of okayness. A feeling like after a few years and you got money in the bank and everything's going good, it's easy to get a feeling like, I don't really feel like there's a problem here anymore. Oh, I know intellectually, yeah, I'm sure. I don't really feel like there's a problem. And self-centered, self-focused, self-centered people, more than anything, will try to run their life on their feelings because that's internal rather than the external reality, which is really what is. And so often we start compromising our own involvement in our recovery. We don't just shut it off. It's a series of incremental compromises. And we just start moving away from what we believed was necessary, just a little bit at a time. As if you were to step back from a person like that, or if they could step back from themselves, what they would see is a person that must secretly believe as time goes on that they don't have as much alcoholism as they had in one time. As if this is something you can outgrow or get over. And you can't. It's a chronic illness. We learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The book goes on the next paragraph to say we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times we were gaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Big words. If you don't know what that means, remember the day, how you felt the day you asked for help. Pitiful, self-pitying, baffling. I can't stand myself. A friend of mine says it's when you get to the place where your morals are deteriorating faster than you can lower your standards. Isn't it funny? We all have that experience, though, of being at one time in our life, being real high morals, all this stuff we'd never do. And then 10 years later, you look back and it looks like looking down railroad tracks that aren't really railroad ties. They're the lines you've crossed of the things you'd never do. Man. We're are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. It doesn't say over any considerable period of drinking. It says over any considerable period. I'll tell you something. I've observed this with a regularity, that the disease of alcoholism progresses within me while I'm in these rooms. It's like it's out some place doing push-ups, waiting for an opportunity to get its foot in the door. Because I've been sober long enough to see a lot of guys get sober and 20 years later drink again. And I know where they were at when they got sober 20 years ago. They didn't pick up where they left off. As a matter of fact, people that are sober a long time that drink again, it's not that they don't ever get back and stay sober the rest of their life, but that statistically it's a tough place to come to. Because the disease progresses within you. This guy I saw years ago that drank after 45 years, the thing that was so startling to me, it wasn't so much the physiological progression of the disease, and that was definitely present. He'd gotten real sick real bad, and that was evident. And plus he was older. But what the real progression was of the ego. He became the I know everything guy. Now here's a guy who's burnt his life to the ground, who's dying, and you can't tell him nothing. He became me and this guy's sponsor, we tried to make a project out of him. We used to drag him to meetings. Sometimes he'd be drunk, sometimes he'd be sober, but it didn't matter. If he was drunk or sober, he knew what was wrong with everybody. You couldn't tell him nothing. And he used to go on and on about, I wasn't that way in the old days, and Bill Wilson was his sponsor. Bill used to tell me this, and you guys don't know what you're talking about. He was so full of himself, because I think that's the thing that progresses, which I think is frightening to me. Because if I drink again, I probably never get back here. Because I'll become the I know guy. And I work with guys that sober a lot of years and drink again, and they become the I know guys. You try to tell them something, they go, yeah, I know. But I think what they're really saying is, shut up. Leave me alone. But they say, yeah, I know. And maybe intellectually they do. But there's something really blocked between their head and their heart. And they don't really know it. And they think they do because they have an intellectual. But recovery from alcoholism is not an intellectual process. It must get from your head to your heart and eventually into your feet. And they never get it into their feet. It just stays up here in their head. It doesn't even get in their heart. It can't even get that far. They're that blocked. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. Boy, we have, too. Whew. In some instances, there has been brief recovery followed always by still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. And I'm telling you, I don't think they ever will. And I'm telling you, I've been around here for generations and watched them try, and I wish they'd quit. About every 4 or 5 years, they come up with something. I remember all the way back to the RAND report, where they convinced that they could turn alcoholics into social drinkers. You know what that accomplished? It killed about 2,000 of us. It just waited to hear that. Oh, yeah, okay, now I can. And it just bled us out of alcohol. I've watched all that stuff over the years. And in the big medical community, oops. I remember, this will sound so bizarre today. I remember when standard operating procedure for doctors treating newly sober alcoholics was to give them an unlimited prescription for Valium because it was non-addictive. And this is safe for people like you. It took a whole generation, and I can't imagine how many thousands of us died. And they're always trying to fix us. But we are beyond human aid. There isn't a pill that can fix me. And if there was, think about it. It's not going to work. Let's imagine that they come up with a pill, Let's say it's going to make me an alcoholic into a non-alcoholic. It's going to, maybe I could take this pill and drink socially. First thing I'm going to think about is, well, how social could I get? I mean, what would happen if I took five of them? Can you smoke them? I mean, can you snort? I mean, you know, because that's the way I think. And you know, who really wants to be a social drinker? You ever drank with social drinkers? You don't want to drink like that. What you want is you want their consequences, but you don't want their drinking. You don't want to be the guy who works hard, busts your butt all day long, gets off work, goes into a bar, has two short beers, and goes home and cuts the grass. No. You don't want to be that. Two short beers, you get a gallon of tequila, and you head for Tijuana. Hey! Well, right. That's our nature. There's no way to change my basic yearning nature. You can't do it. Can't do it. I wish they'd quit. Because despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they're in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore not alcoholic. By every form of self-deception and experimentation. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't see the alcoholism sometimes because I also did a lot of drugs, and I kept pointing it out. Well, I don't know if I'm alcoholic, and I did a lot of that too, and it was very confusing to me. I got a riddle for you. What do you call a person who is born with the disease of alcoholism to alcoholic parents who they resent and are determined never to be like? What do you call a person born with alcoholism under those conditions? A drug addict. Because you've got an itch you're going to scratch one way or another. And you can dig your heels in and never touch that. But the basic malady of my spirit doesn't change. And I think you could take somebody with alcoholism, pluck them off this planet, drop them down on a planet where ethyl alcohol chemically cannot be fermented, and they'll find rocks or something. Something. Or they'll die trying because you haven't. The real problem is I'm looking. I need the medicine for the disease of alcoholism. If anyone who's showing inability to control his drinking and do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows, we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. And there's a whole list of things that they say that were all common in 1939. People tried it. If today's standards, you'd add onto that list, you could add all kinds of different medications and treatment centers and primal screaming and reparenting your inner child and gestalt therapy and vision center and sweat lodges and on and on and on. I mean, we are the people who buy the self-help books, for God's sakes. I mean, we are, really, you know. Everybody gets sober, has a box of them somewhere in the garage. You know. There you sit with coffee and new people, you know. Did you read Psycho-Cybernetic? Oh, yeah, I read that. Did you read this? Oh, yeah, I read that. How about Primal Scream? Oh, yeah, I tried that. Well, I really wanted to try that crap. Ask and sigh. Nothing wrong with any of that. It's just not a treatment for alcoholism. I think we're the kind of people that we grab on to good answers, but for the wrong problem. I'm the kind of guy who gets a broken leg, and I read somewhere that jogging was good for me, so I try to jog for a broken leg. I'm crazy like that. Volume 31, it says, we do not like to pronounce any individual alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself, and here's the test. You want to find out if you're alcoholic? Book suggests a test. I don't personally suggest the test. It says, step over the nearest barroom, try some controlled drinking, try to drink and stop abruptly, try it more than once, it will not take long for you to decide if you're honest with yourself about it. It may be worth a bad case of the jitters to get a full knowledge of your condition. Well, 1939, maybe that's the risk you take, a bad case of the jitters. 2006, I don't know. You might get in your car and kill yourself or a family of four. I think we've upped the ante a little bit. I wouldn't want to recommend that test because I'd hate to say, why don't you go try it? And then something would happen to you and you die because you don't have any clue how powerful that allergy is. You think you do, but you don't. You think you can control it, but you can't. And you'd try that test and you'd let that tiger out of the cage and you can't get it back in until it just tears you to the ground. And I don't want to recommend a test. And objectively, when you think about it, if you play it through in your head and imagine the scenario, I don't think it's a viable test for most of us. Let's hypothetically, okay, we're going to go down here to this bar. We're going to go take the test. I'm going to go in there, I'm going to have two drinks, that's it. Shut her down, go home, don't smoke nothing, take nothing, 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 two drinks, that's it. Well, about halfway through the second drink, it's going to become very apparent to me that this is a bad test day. There'd be somebody there I need to have a drink with. There'd be a ball game would come on. I got to watch. A bad test now. Tomorrow, better test day. And tomorrow, somewhere between the first and second drink, it's like a key turns in my head. And the phenomenon, the allergic reaction happens. And I don't know that it's happening. And one of the things that the phenomenon of craving does is it gets all my cognizant ability to justify, to rationalize, to minimize danger. It gets my whole mental abilities right behind whatever is necessary to make it seem perfectly logical and sensible to me to have the next drink. And I think it's my idea. I don't know that my mind is working overtime to justify satisfying a craving that I don't even know I have because it's such a subtle thing. And that's called alcoholism. And I relapsed for 7.5 years. And somewhere in 1979, I was sober a little while, and somebody who knew that I relapsed for a lot of years asked me what was different. And I'll tell you what happened to me is best pictured by this part of the book on the bottom of page 151. And this is really my story. It's really what brought me to the table in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's not what I thought. You know what I thought would happen is you'll hit there. I thought there was some kind of ultimate bottom where you do something so horrible and terrible that it snaps you into sobriety. But I don't think that's what happened, because my last drunk was not my worst. I've had some that were horrific nightmares, and I drank afterwards. But here's what happened to me. It says, now and then a serious drinker being dry at the moment says, I don't miss it at all. Feel better, work better, having a better time. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself inwardly. Secretly, I would give anything to take a half dozen drinks and get away with them. I will presently try the old game again. Why? Because I'm not happy about my sobriety, really. I'm pretending like I am, but really I'm not. There's a hole in the center of who I am. I don't know what's wrong with me. People would ask me, Bob, what's wrong? And I don't know. So I just tell them nothing. Because it's not that anything's wrong. When you have the malady of your being or spirit that's called alcoholism, it's not that anything in particular is wrong, it's just that nothing is right. I'm like a fish out of water. And it drives on me. It drives on me. I would give anything to take a half dozen drinks. It says, I will presently try the old game again. I'm not happy about my sobriety. I can't picture life without alcohol. And it's true, I couldn't. So I tried a lot of stuff. I tried a lot of medications. I tried, because I know I can't drink, but I can't live without something, for God's sakes. Oh, man, I tried marijuana. It's organic, for God's sakes. I mean, you know, God wouldn't have put it on the earth if I wasn't supposed to smoke it, you know. But the real thing is, I need something here. I ain't no good. I ain't no good on the natch. I don't fit. I can't make it out in that world without something. And then here's exactly what happened to me. It says, someday, and the day came, you will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then you will know loneliness, such as few do. You'll be at the jumping off place, and you'll wish for the end. 1978, I stood on a bridge trying to take my own life. Because of that. I got the truth, and the truth is that drinking is horrible. It's pathetic, it's self-pitying, depressing. I feel horrible when I drink. I drink now, just there's no party left in it. I drink to blot it out. And then I get sober, and it's bad too, because sobriety feels like I'm doing time. And it's depressing and lonely, and I don't fit anywhere. I can't imagine life with it, because this is bad. I can't get it back to the good old days, and I can't imagine life without it either. It says we'll be at the jumping off place. So I stood on the bridge trying to get up enough courage to kill myself. It says we'll know a loneliness such as few do. If you had come along and said to me, Bob, get off that bridge. This is alcoholism. Don't you know what you're doing to yourself? I wouldn't have thought it was alcoholism. It didn't feel like that. Felt like I was dying of loneliness because I didn't fit anywhere drunk and I didn't fit anywhere sober. The magic was gone and I couldn't get it back. And if you've ever tasted the magic sense of community that you had when you were a kid and you were a part of when you drank, and I can't get that back no more. So I'm trying to take my own life, but I couldn't commit suicide because I'm secretly a coward. And at the last moment when it was time to leap, I broke down and started sobbing and cursing myself. And I came off of that drunk in a hospital in Las Vegas, Nevada, 2,500 miles away, and something had changed in my spirit. I didn't know until I heard Chuck Chamberlain talk that I had been surrendered by the bottle. I didn't do it. It's not an intellectual exercise. It's something that happened, something between God and my insides and my alcoholism. Something broke. Almost like breaking the spirit of a wild horse. If you work on it long enough, eventually you can break its spirit. And it broke my spirit. And I sat in that hospital, and for the first time in 7.5 years, I actually heard the people in AA. I didn't criticize them in my head. I didn't make them out to be idiots. I didn't secretly laugh with my partner and pick them apart. I actually heard them. And I started to connect with them. And I started to follow them and actually do what they told me to do. And my life started to change. And in early sobriety, a guy, you know, I came off the streets. I'd been a homeless guy by now for a couple of years. People gave me clothes to wear because I had no clothes. They gave me cigarettes because I'm all, you know, I have nothing. They gave me even books to read. Guys would clean out their old novels and stuff and give me stuff to read. Here, would you like this? You know, I was like the rummage center yard sale clearinghouse of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got my first apartment. They gave me furniture, old couches and mattresses and stuff. Everybody, you know, I got AA fed me. And this guy one day is giving me a bunch of clothes and stuff and a bunch of novels. And I start reading this one book. And it was not a book about alcoholism. It was just a novel. And I read something in there that blew my mind. I'll tell you, it hit me to such a level that all of a sudden I connected all the dots. All of a sudden I knew exactly what had happened to me. And here's what the novels talked about. There was a scene in there in the middle of the book where it talked about these scientists that were doing experiments on the human brain. And they discovered that in the human brain was a part called the pleasure center. It had a long Latin name, but they call it the pleasure center. It's the part of the brain that allows you to experience the euphoria from alcohol and drugs. It's where you get high. So what they did is they took these laboratory rats and they put two tiny wire filaments into the pleasure center of the rat's brain, and they would pass a mild electric stimulus through those wires, just enough to stimulate the pleasure center. And what they discovered is the rats would get high. So what they did is they hooked up the juice to a pedal in the rat's cage, and the rat would learn it could hit that pedal and get high. So the rat would just lay on the damn pedal. I mean, he doesn't even eat. He doesn't drink water. He doesn't have sex. He doesn't do anything. He's just hitting that pedal. And he hits the pedal until he dies, usually of dehydration. Every alcoholic gets that. Oh, yeah, hit the pedal. I can tell that. I go look out of the audience whenever I tell that story. See the glazed eyes. Oh, yeah, hit the pedal. All right, we all get that. But that's not what really blew my mind. These scientists would wait till a rat was just about dead, and they turn the juice off. And this time the rat hits the pedal and nothing happens. And he hits it again, and nothing happens, and again, and again, and again. And finally, after countless futile attempts to turn the juice back on, the rat finally gets it that the party is over once and for all. And instead of being able to go back to just being a rat, the rat curls up in a ball and lays on the floor of the cage to die. Because without the juice, there's nothing to live for. In 1978, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I felt exactly like that rat. And thank God for the alert and awake members of Alcoholics Anonymous that looked for guys like me. And they took advantage of my weakness and pushed me into doing some things I never would have done if I would have been in my right mind. If I'd had it all together, if I'd have been full of me, I would have never done. And they started to change my life. And I've never been the same since. And I want to tell you something, and I'll end with this, I'll pass it back to Scott, see if there's anything. But I believe, as I stand here, and I believe with everything in me, that the sole purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is one thing, and one thing only. It's not to get you to quit drinking. You want to quit drinking, punch a cop. You'll quit for a while. Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to do one thing. It's designed to turn the juice back on. It's the single most important promise of all the 12 steps. What we're going to start getting into the process that leads to this conclusion tomorrow morning. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, something's going to waken up within you. Didn't something wake up inside you one time in your life when you'd walk into a party or a bar so depressed and full of yourself and you'd have four or five drinks? Didn't something wake up within you? Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to turn the juice back on. Scott, you want to say anything for a quick?
We're going to take about a 12-hour break, 11 and a half-hour break. There is a discussion meeting starting at 10 o'clock in this room. Got that right? And we will start tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock sharp. And hope to see you then. We like to close a little bit unusual. This is something Bob and I really treasure. We both were in AA long before somebody came up with some clever way to start the Lord's Prayer. And we were also here long before they came up with something to say after Amen. And so what we're going to ask you to do is something we do at our men's retreats. And that's, I think we've probably got too many to try for the circle. So what? In just a second, I'm going to ask you to stand and stay where you are. Take hands where you can. We're going to whisper the Lord's Prayer. This is something we do in the jails. We're going to whisper the Lord's Prayer, and after Amen, don't shake hands, don't chant anything. We're going to have another moment of silence. I want you to see if you can feel the love in this room during that moment of silence. I think you'll be amazed, and I think you'll find that you can. All right, let's stand where you are, please. Get down here. Yeah, I have to use this. A moment of silence in honor of those that carried this message to us that are gone now. Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. God bless us all. Safe travel. See you in the morning. I love you.